You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we're in Bagnères de Luchon.
The noise there was some children at the finish today chanting Ali Gautier in support of Cyril Gautier, who was in the breakaway and trying to win the stage. Hello, I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel Freib.
Evening.
Hello. Lionel, where are we?
We're just outside Bagnères de Luchon.
We're in Bagnères de Luchon.
We're just outside the village town, aren't we? We're not actually in the nice bit.
Arguing
have
already.
You figured out why this is sometimes referred to as Bagnères de Luchon and at other times just Luchon?
Well, Bagnères just basically means spa, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but you know, you come into the town and it's signed Luchon, not Bagnères de Luchon.
Yeah, well, do they refer to Leamington Spa always as Leamington Spa,
yes,
or just Leamington? Well, the football team is just Leamington.
Oh, God.
What an awful start.
Where are we, Lionel? Where are we, Lionel?
We're in Bagnères de Luchon. We're next to Racing Club Luchon's little rugby pitch there.
It's very nice. Nice little... Lovely. I mean, it is a beautiful location. As we come here quite a lot on the tour, surrounded by the Pyrenees, very green. And the town itself is delightful, isn't it? The tour comes here a lot. Now, we were at the start as well. We had the rest day in Carcassonne, and we were at the start today, Lionel, and having a little nosy around. It was quite interesting. I had quite a long stage today, and a very interesting stage that we will get onto in a moment or two, to notice that one rider was warming up, and that was Geraint Thomas. And I grabbed a quick word with him, and also with Romain Bardet, who started the day in the white jersey for Best Young Rider. Here is Geraint Thomas and Romain Bardet.
Yeah. You were riding very well the other day, Geraint, in those sort of high mountains. Did you feel that you were quite comfortable in that sort of terrain?
More comfortable than the past few years, for sure. It was still tough going, though. I might have had a poker face on, but I was hurting inside a lot. Yeah, I'm just enjoying racing. And like I said before, it's just 6 one-day races now, so hopefully we can...
And you've been sort of getting stuck in every day pretty much since the start. How are you feeling going into the third week?
Yeah, for sure, I'm tired and feeling it now. But, you know, I think everybody is, and I think you just got to get in that mindset that that's racing, isn't it? It's never easy. Do everything you can, you know, warm up and prepare as best you can. And
so
just
the ambition now to win a stage before you get to Paris?
Yeah, for sure, we'll try. You know, it's easier said than done. It's just hard just to get in the break. But, yeah, we're going to try.
Are you the man for that, or Nieve or somebody else?
I think we're all just going to try. I think maybe more so me today and then the other boys a bit later on maybe. But, yeah, I think we all just pull together and just be represented for sure.
How are your legs now going into the third week of the tour? Do you feel strong for this few days in the Pyrenees?
Yeah, I guess I'm stronger in the third week than at the start of the tour, but I will see after a rest day. It's never easy to race a stage like this. And so we will see, but I have big hopes.
Do you have an idea of how much time you think you would need over the likes of Van Garder and Valverde before the time trial?
I know, it's not a question that I want to ask, because we will see. There is 3 big stages, and we will see how it goes after these 3 big stages.
But your ambition to take some more time in the 3 days?
Sure.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freib.
So we heard there from Geraint Thomas and Romain Bardet, both talking very bullishly before the stage. Thomas said he's very keen to get in the breakaway. This was a stage he said that he thought might suit him. Didn't happen. Two Sky riders were in the big breakaway that went away, Bernard Eisel and Vasyl Kirianka. And he was third on the stage in the end, Kirianka. And Bardet had a bit of a disappointing day, I think. He lost contact with the lead group and as they climbed the Porte de Ballet. And it was quite a lot happened, considering there was a long way from the top of the climb down to the finish in Luchon, or Bagnères de Luchon. And quite a lot. I mean, TJ Van Garderen was the first overall contender, a man tipped only last night in the Velo News podcast by Andy Hood to finish second. He was very firm in his belief that he would finish second, but that looks a lot less likely tonight. He slipped down a few places, lost quite a bit of time. And Romain Bardet was one of the next to go as well. Was that a surprise to you, Daniel?
Not really, in the sense that he hasn't looked quite as powerful as his compatriot Pino. he hadn't recce'd the Pyrenees. I'm not sure how important that might have been. I suppose the biggest surprise is that Jean-Christophe Perrault is still hanging in there. The 37-year-old from AG2R, La Mondiale, Bardet's teammate. He doesn't have a fantastic record in major tours. He's finished in top 10 here at the Tour de France before, but has certainly never threatened for the podium. But he's looking increasingly durable, isn't he?
Well, we've not really spoken, but we've been talking a lot about Bardet and Pinot, and we haven't really spoken about Perrault at all. And yeah, he seems to have come from nowhere. He, of course, he finished second in the stage a couple of years ago to David Miller. He got away with him. He was also quite highly placed last year, wasn't he, until he had the terrible crashes and then pulled out the race in the time trial. Did he not start the time trial with a dislocated collarbone or something?
Hadn't he crashed in warm-up and then he crashed
That's right, in the actual race? In front of his family, yeah. So he had a very unfortunate ending last year, but he's riding incredibly well. He's not a pleasant rider to look at. I think he's a former mountain biker, isn't he?
And he's a silver medalist in 2008, I think, in a mountain bike.
Yeah, he looks like a mountain biker. He looks like a mountain biker. He's got that sort of upright style, sits quite far forward on the bike and sort of punching the pedals in the way that a mountain biker sometimes does. But yeah, what can you tell us about him, Daniel?
Well, he turned pro very late, and he is a multiple French time trial champion, which you wouldn't necessarily expect if you saw, you know, his stature. He's not a particularly big guy, and certainly AG2R La Mondiale are quite optimistic, looking forward to that final time trial from Bergerac to Périgueux, or is it the other way around? I can't remember. The long final time trial on the penultimate day, they think that Perrault will probably make up time, certainly on Pinot, possibly even Valverde. In that stage.
By the way, I should say nothing against mountain bikers before anyone says, just as the way that somebody rides, sometimes they look, I think Peter Sagan looks still a bit like a mountain biker. Cadel Evans rides a bit like a mountain biker. It's just the sort of style they climb in particular.
Well, yeah, it's much less of a kind of fluid pedal stroke. It's more of a kind of almost like crushing grapes. It's
further forward on the saddle as well.
I like that. That's very good.
They tend to not sit as far back as guys who've ridden road bikes in their formative years.
Yeah, another thing I've noticed with mountain bikers often when they convert to the road is they go very, very well very soon, you know, in the first year or two, and then they often plateau. That hasn't really been the case with Jean-Christophe Perrault. He's continued to improve slowly, and he's heading for his best result in the Tour.
Just on AG2R, what do you guys think about the way they're riding? Because they're just, Perrault and Bardet are riding like individuals. They're not really looking after one another.
Maybe they've got it right. You know, the way the stage went today. I mean, I was at the start just before I spoke to Bardet, Ned Bolting, our ITV colleague and podcast competitor, spoke to Bardet. And he asked him about the relationship between him and Perrault and whether they were riding together or riding as basic as individuals, and it has looked that way, that they have been riding as individuals, you know, and we speak a lot about whether you can come to the Tour with two leaders. I guess they've done it. They've sort of hedged their bets a little bit with both, and it's ended up that probably Perrault has the best chance of making it onto the podium.
Yeah, I think it works if you're not trying to win the Tour de France. What they did today, Perrault carrying on when Bardet was dropped, I think 4 or 5 kilometres from the summit, made perfect sense, because you know, the effect of any sort of beneficial effect of drafting there was going to be fairly minimal, particularly, you know, on a steep climb like the Porte de Balais. Then there was a long descent, and I think they got it exactly right today.
Certainly, as the age gap between the two of them is so significant, Perrault is 37, Romain Bardet is still eligible for the white jersey. Perhaps it would be a hard sell to Perrault to say, well, sacrifice yourself for Bardet when this may be his last chance to ride for a high position on GC.
Yeah, and let's not be too hard on Bardet. I mean, he's 23 years old. He's ridden fantastically well. He's still riding fantastically well. He's fifth overall. You know, this could be the best performance by a young Frenchman that young since Laurent Fignon in 1983, who was 22, I think, when he won the Tour. But, you know, if he can finish in the top six, even in the top 10 as a 23-year-old, I think it augurs extremely well for the future. Daniel, you're going to say something else about Bardet. I was going to talk about Pinot in a moment.
I know you'll enjoy that. Is this the time to cut in about Van Garderen?
Yeah.
Yes. I know we've heard from a lot, Max, in the last few days. Max Chandry, the BMC Direct Sportif. I caught up with him at the finish. He was looking very despondent, actually. The whole of the BMC staff was looking very despondent, except Jim Okovitz, who was ready to go out on a bike ride. He was fully kitted out in full BMC gear, had his bike ready. But yeah, Max was sort of sitting on a wall, contemplating the day's stage, and he admitted that it had been a pretty bad day at the office for TJ Van Garderen.
We're trying to understand what happened to TJ, if he didn't eat. He was a bit empty. We haven't really spoken, just let him cool down a bit. It's funny because this morning I said, you know, eat, make sure you have put some solid food in. You know, it's a long day. So I hope that wasn't the case. You know, I'm always passing gels on when I give bidons out here from the car. So, but let's see. You know, it's a battle lost. You know, but it's not the war. So,
Do you know, has he had problems after rest days before?
Well, no, not really. I mean, we just did like every other rest day. You know, we didn't go for too long or too short of a ride. We just rode and tried his TT bike, and I think everything was pretty good.
You talked about giving him food all the time throughout the stage. Did it look like a bonk to you?
Well, I don't know. I try and give food to the riders what come and get bidons, you know. So as they come and get bidons, I always pass a few extra gels and just keep them in the pocket.
Yeah.
A gel in a moment like that can save your life, but I don't know what he did before that, so yeah, we'll have to get to the hotel and kind of see what's what.
Just last thing, of these three Pyrenean stages, sort of on paper, which one would you say would have suited TJ the best? And obviously different lengths, different difficulty.
Yeah, everything was different. There's not one in particular. I mean, today was a day we were really hoping to do some, you know, we with the descent and how he can end, he's pretty good. And we had a good plan, but, you know, obviously plans don't go accordingly. So we'll see. We'll just reassess.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So the stage was won today by Michael Rogers of the Australian with Tinkoff Saxo. We'll talk about him and hear from him later, and also his colourful team boss, Oleg Tinkoff. But let's talk about Thibaut Pinot, who was perhaps, apart from Rogers, the man of the match, maybe. I mean, this was a stage that we know he was nervous about, with that particularly fast and quite treacherous descent off the Port de Valais, which is dangerous enough without a press car appearing in the middle of it. And a press car appeared in between Pinot and Nibali, and that really shouldn't have happened. And I gather that press car has been ejected from the race.
Well, it's had its official stickers peeled off already.
Well, we're just looking at it and sitting here, and the stickers have gone.
They got a straight red card, didn't they? Our friend from France Télévisions, Nicolas Jay, got a yellow card a couple of days ago for drafting. Or his motorbike pilot was accused of drafting Richie Porte back to the bunch on the day when he had a very, very difficult time on the way into Nîmes, wasn't it?
I think, obviously, without making light of this situation, the cars with the green stickers that get to drive in the race, I've done it a couple of times years and years ago. It is incredibly stressful, nerve-wracking, and in the Tour de France, you know, even more so.
Particularly on descent when a car cannot go faster than
you don't
a Tour de France rider.
I mean, it looked terrible. No, it was embarrassing.
But, you know, I hope people don't sort of absolutely castigate the unfortunate drivers.
We've already been accused, Lionel, of being the culprits. And I'd like to point out we're in a very stylish black Jaguar, not a silver people carrier. Please, you know, you'll know us if we do pop up in the middle of the race. But we'll not do that. That would be sort of guerrilla advertising. No, we'll not do that. We're not got any plans to do that at all. Let's talk about Thibaut Pinot, because that was at a point in the race when he'd actually got a little bit of a gap over Nibali. Not so significant. It was right near the top of the Port de Valais that he got clear. But he looked very strong on that climb. It was Jeremy Roy, wasn't it, who was a fantastic teammate to him on that climb. He got dropped a couple of times, came back, really did a lot of work. Movistar were the people that did the real damage early on.
No, Jeremy Watt was in the break this morning, and it was Arnaud Janssen.
Yeah, apologies. It was Jeremy Roy later on coming into Luchon.
Jeremy Roy, who I spoke to at the finish, and he said that he'd stopped, he'd got the order to stop, sit up from the break, and he actually stopped at the roadside with a spectator who had told him that Van Garderen was dropped and various other contenders for the overall classification were dropped, and he couldn't quite believe how well the stage was going, and he said he stood with the spectator and listened to the radio for 5 minutes.
Brilliant. Well, he was starting to look pretty fresh at the finish. I mean, that maybe explains it. But Movistar did a lot of damage early on in the climb. They really shelled out Van Garderen and Bardet. But then Pino seemed to attack that climb. I mean, was his thinking partly because he was nervous about the descent? Do you think he wanted to have that group as small as possible?
Yeah, I mean, it's something he's done throughout his career. You know, when he going back to when he won the Val d'Aosta, the Giro della Val d'Aosta as an amateur, he really struggled on descents there, and that's one of the biggest stage races in the world on the amateur scene, and pretty much on every climb there he was attacking in the last kilometer of climbs just to give himself a head start, and I thought he might do that today. In the event, he had Janssen, who rode superbly, gave him more support than he's had on the climb so far today, and looked fairly comfortable. I mean, there was a time near the end of the descent where Nibali's group got about 100-200 meters, but thanks to Jeremy Waugh, got back on. Pino did, and it's nice to see sort of just how excited La Française des Jeux FDJ are about, you know, what's happening with Pino. Marc Madiot was there striding through the melee at the finish line, pushing people out of the way so he could get a good spot in front of the big screen. Thibaut's brother Julien, who's his coach, was also wrestling through the crowd with a home trainer. One of the things they've done throughout the tour is that they've put Pino on his turbo trainer within almost seconds of him crossing the line. They've been screaming at him to get on his turbo trainer to obviously help with his recovery. And they feel like they're kind of living a dream at the moment. Obviously, Pino and his brother and the team in general, they can't quite believe how well this tour is going.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a real shot at the podium. I mean, that the other reason for riding as hard as they were riding was the distance Bardet, of course, I think. And, you know, it was funny, this morning there was a French journalist there was warning us not to ask him about Pino, because there is, and you know, looking towards the future, it would be brilliant if a real French rivalry developed, wouldn't it? I mean, over the next coming years between those two, and there's Warren Barguil as well.
No, yeah, I mean, they get on pretty well at the moment. Two days ago on the stage to Nîmes, they spent the first hour of the stage side by side, pretty much just, you know, shooting the breeze and talking to each other. To go back to what you said, Rich, about Movistar, this was something we mentioned yesterday. They're one of the very few teams in the race at the moment who don't have major physical problems, don't have illnesses, don't have injuries, and we thought that they might be very strong today, and they were. And they looked quite ominous looking ahead to the next two stages in the Pyrenees, certainly also in light of what they did last year in the Pyrenees on the stage to Bagnères de Bigorre with multiple climbs.
Yeah, they did, but their leader's not good enough, is he? He's not going to be good enough, I don't think, to put Nibali under pressure. Although, having said that, when they came over the top of the Porte de Balès, Nibali was struggling to hold Pinot's wheel a bit there.
This does offer a glimmer of hope for the next couple of days, which are both summit finishes as opposed to climbs and then descents. And I mean, you don't know how much to read into that. It reminded me a bit of the stage earlier on in the tour where Nibali just let Contador's wheel go a little bit on a climb, and that's sensible. I mean, you can give Pino, you know, 100 metres at the top of a climb, Nibali would get him back. Why go into the red to stay with him over the top of the climb? I think that was maybe just smart on Nibali's part.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
Welcome back to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. At this stage in the tour, we want to give some thanks to some people. Lionel's nodding his head approvingly. Yeah, let's thank some people. We want to thank the Telegraph, who have supported the podcast very well and given us a great platform. Adam Sills in particular, Mike Adamson, Tom Carey and John McCleary. I want to thank Jaguar, without whom, etc. They have sponsored us throughout the tour. Other thank yous, Nigel Brown, who's a great help to us, John Mooney, our producer, editor, and Paul Scoins, another producer, editor. Anyone else, Lionel?
Ciro
Scone Emilio.
Simon Gill for his company and his pictures.
The photographer at the start of the tour.
Sorry, I wouldn't be surprised to see Ciro appear any second now. He usually does, doesn't he?
Yeah, but just before that, talking of Simon Gill and his photos, we've actually got a competition which we're running on thecyclingpodcast.com. If you click on there and then read the story to win a framed print from the opening stage of the Tour de France in Yorkshire, Simon captured a fantastic picture which was a sports photo of the day for another newspaper that isn't the Telegraph, but another reputable newspaper. It's a great shot of the crowd and the bunch coming up on the Côte de Buttertubs. It's just, you know, basically people and the hillside. Lovely picture. You can see the picture. We've got one of those to give away. It will be framed and delivered to you. And to have a chance to win that, just predict the winner at Hautacam, Thursday's stage to Hautacam, stage 18. Leave the name of the rider you think will win that stage in the comments section at the bottom of that article on the pods and blogs section of thecyclingpodcast.com.
Yes, we're on Twitter as well, at @cycling_podcast, and Facebook. And we have a winner of our competition to win a phone call from Ciro Scognamiglio. The winner is Mr. Ian Fraser, who entered on Facebook. In fact, he suggested the competition in the first place, so I just thought, I'll pick him. And he deserves to win the call from Ciro. So, Ian, please contact us via Facebook, or however you want to contact us. There's a helicopter. And I will set up the phone call with Ciro. I think you'll enjoy it. Our other friend and colleague, Francois Thomazeau, was supposed to join us tonight, but unfortunately all this French action is making him rather busy, so he has promised to join us in the next couple of days, either tomorrow or at Hautacam.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So, Michael Rogers, the Australian 35-year-old now, first ever stage win at the Tour de France. He's been trying for quite a while, although he's often been in teams where he's not really had an opportunity to try for a stage win. He won two stages at the Giro. He's obviously in terrific form. He says he's going as well as he has ever gone in his career. And I hate to say plan B, but the Tinkoff-Saxo plan B is working pretty well with Contador gone. They've won two stages now, and Micah also took over the King of Mountains jersey today.
Well, yeah, may as well then tee up a very brief chat I had with Oleg Tinkoff. He's quite a charismatic fellow. I think, Daniel, you probably know him a lot better than I do, or have more dealings with him. But he's quite striking. He's got the bleach blonde wavy hair and the baseball cap and the mirrored sunglasses and the tan and the money. You know, he's not an oligarch, Richard, you keep telling me, but his career progress from jeans salesman to owner of a bank is, you know, pretty impressive.
Quite remarkable. Yeah. Let's hear from Oleg Tinkoff and then also from Mick Rogers, who I spoke to at the finish. He spoke a bit about what the stage of victory meant. He also explained a conversation that he appeared to be having with Thomas Vogtler on the descent of the Port de Ballas. I asked him what he'd said to Vogtler. It sounded like he was giving him tactical advice. He felt that Europcar messed the stage up tactically. So here is Oleg Tinkoff and then Mick Rogers.
How do you sum up today's victory in comparison to the one the other day for Rafał Majka? It's turned a disastrous tour in one way into a success.
As when Alberto crashed, we had a team meeting during the rest day. We went to the cafeteria with the riders, me, Bjarne, and we sit down and we said, guys, we have to show the character and we have to continue to fight. And I'm glad that we said we have to win at least two stages. So that's what the plan seems to be realized. And we have, because I said we have to be, at least. I'm so happy. Of course, first victory was very much more emotional because it was my first ever Tour de France victory. And now it's the second. But still, I'm so happy for Michael because he has had a long career. And finally, he won the very first Tour de France stage. So I'm happy for him. He's the nicest guy in the team. He's a captain, so super happy.
When you had that meeting with the team and the riders, did you thump your fist on the table, or is that just a stereotype?
No. We were talking nicely, and we sort of, me and Bjarne, we sort of asked them, because we said, and for Alberto, for yourself, for the sponsors, for me, Bjarne asked them to do something in this tour, and we did. It's fantastic.
Obviously, a stage that I'd been thinking about for a while. It was either today or tomorrow. I tell you what, it was a tough, you know, really to get that break was really tough. A lot of wind at the start. Obviously, in the final, I attacked on the climb many times, but, you know, I was unable to get Vogtler and company. I was unable to drop them. So, obviously, on the descent where I made the difference, actually, and I think Europcar made a few little tactical errors that I picked up on very fast and was able to take advantage of.
You had some words with Tommy Vogtler on the descent there. What did you say to him?
Well, he was telling me he's not going to pull because he had a rider behind. You know, obviously using his tactical advantage, and I said, no, we're not playing games today. You know, this is I've been in this position too many times to play games. It was probably, I think, that was the error.
Were you slightly concerned about the two guys coming up?
Well, certainly that was his error because he had a situation that he could control. And then once five guys are there, all of a sudden you can't control it.
So that was Oleg Tinkov there, you heard just before Mick Rogers. And the thing that struck me about the very brief conversation we had there was that he talked about calling a meeting after Contador pulled out of the Tour de France with all of the staff and all of the riders. And I tried to make a joke about whether, you know, the stereotypical kind of fist on the table to...
It wasn't one of your dad jokes.
It wasn't a dad joke, no. But I wanted to know what the sort of tone of that meeting was. And he said that Oleg said basically 2 stage wins minimum. You know, that's what I want from this tour. That's how we're going to salvage the Tour de France for the team. And I don't know. I wonder whether the same kind of conversation would have happened at Sky. I'm not quite sure it would have gone the same way.
Certainly there was a conversation at Sky yesterday on the rest day in the team bus, because Sir Dave Brailsford locked all the staff in the bus, and they had a long chat about how this tour was going and how it might go better in the future. It is very similar for them to 2010. You know, it's very much been a case of feast or famine at the tour for Team Sky. 2011, you could say, was a medium-sized, generous buffet. They won 2 stages with Edvald Boasenhagen there after Bradley Wiggins had crashed out. But I think this is definitely looking like a case of famine. Kirianka, third on the stage, was a decent result. They had 2 men in the break. They're trying. Geraint Thomas, I'm sure, will try again. But I think today was possibly his last chance.
It was odd where and when Kirianka chose to make his effort, though, wasn't it? He rode on the front for a very long time on the Port de Ballas. Didn't really shred the group too much. So when the pressure went on with Cyril Gauthier and then Thomas Vokler, Mick Rogers and José Serpa, Kirianka went backwards, and then he had to sort of haul himself back up to the front. It looked like he chose the wrong moment to make his effort. But
I mean, this is something that I think they've realised almost after the event, after Chris Froome's withdrawal, that they have got a team and also a squad which is light on winners, light on guys that are in a winning habit. And you know, Kirianka is someone who's won stages in Grand Tours before. He won on a famous stage over the Colle delle Finestre in the Giro. However, he did look like a guy today who perhaps wasn't particularly confident in his ability to win that stage. And obviously the sort of cycling transfer window is about to open up, and one of the areas that Sky want to address is that they want to get more winners on board.
Yeah, well, I mean, they miss Mick Rogers, yeah. Frankly. I mean, Mick Rogers was a key member of that team in 2012 when Bradley Wiggins won. And I was reminded of his ability today on the Port de Ballas when Gauthier attacked, and Rogers didn't react to it at all. He just Gauthier and Vokler were both launching these very impressive kind of showboating attacks, and it reminded me a bit of 2012 when Rogers was constantly reassuring Wiggins, don't react when Cadel Evans or whoever was jumping off the front, just don't react, keep the pace steady, measure your effort. And you could see him just sitting there just very slowly hauling Gauthier back.
I think another area that Sky will try to address, and they want to address, is they want more kind of big personalities on board. And Michael Rogers is quite a softly spoken guy, and not the most demonstrative, but in a racing sense he is quite a big personality. And I think their squad here at the moment, you know, you look at Mikel Nieve, who is apparently very happy at Sky, but he has the communication barrier to get over straight away. Kirianka is certainly very quiet. Danny Pay is a sort of selfless, almost a shrinking violet in a team environment, I think. So that is also something that they want to address.
Yeah, I think there was one of you witnessed Dave Brailsford embracing Mick Rogers at the Start Village this morning.
Not
you. Somebody I spoke to today witnessed it. There was a very warm embrace between them. I mean, we should mention that Mick Rogers is having an incredible sort of Indian summer. It's kind of amazing that he's racing at all. He returned at the Giro having had the uncertainty of a possible doping case hanging over his head after he tested positive for clenbuterol at the end of last season. And yeah, you know, the case against him was dropped. There was some suspicion that he'd had meat containing clenbuterol in China. So, you know, it's amazing that he's racing at all. Perhaps that enforced break has physically and perhaps mentally too done him some good.
Yeah, and also the fact that he would have come into this tour expecting to work for Alberto Contador and do the job for him that he did for Bradley Wiggins 2 years ago. A slightly different style of job. He would have been doing a lot more of the controlling on the front in the mountains. He wouldn't have had to reassure Bradley Wiggins he wouldn't have to reassure Alberto Contador not to jump after people the same way that he was with Bradley Wiggins. But as soon as they lost Contador, Michael Rogers is the kind of rider that would step up. I mean, he has been pretty selfless for a number of years, not just for Wiggins, but also before that as part of kind of Mark Cavendish's lead out.
I'm not sure Cavendish would necessarily agree with that.
Well, no, but I mean, he was part of that team that delivered quite a lot of wins.
He was part of that team, but I think a reluctant part of that team at times.
Yeah, I mean, I think Cavendish took umbrage at in 2010 when things weren't going well for Cavendish in the spring. The Tour of Romandy, he was almost sort of sent home in disgrace by his team for. He celebrated a victory with a V sign, didn't he?
Cavendish, we see, not Rogers.
Yeah, Cavendish, and then
he explained that it was
some reference to the Battle of Agincourt, and then a few weeks later in the Tour of Switzerland, he was involved in a bad crash with Heinrich Hausler, and his sort of season seemed to be kind of imploding, and there were question marks over whether he should even go to the Tour de France, and he felt that Mick Rogers was an advocate for. Well, Mick Rogers himself was having a very good season. He'd won the Tour of California, and Cavendish thought that Mick Rogers perhaps wanted to pursue his own goals at the Tour de France and not ride for Cavendish's sprint train.
They also, in 2012, when they were reunited at Team Sky, the stage into Brive that Cavendish won, he felt that Mick Rogers was one member of the team who wasn't particularly helpful in that stage and was reluctant to focus any of the team's efforts on helping him. And I think Bosenhagen and Bradley Wiggins were the guys that really set that up for him, and he felt that at one point Mick Rogers might be actually writing against him in that particular stage. He just said that as a throwaway comment.
Just one last thing.
I probably shouldn't say it on air.
Just one last thing on...
Too late now.
Just one last thing on Sky and recruitment. I'm at the risk of sounding like Richard Baskin Robbins more, the king of the scoops.
Actually, I've only got one.
Let me finish. We talked earlier in the tour about Sky's interest in Lars Boom. I understand that has cooled slightly. I wouldn't rule it out that he would join them, but he's asking price was betraying my northern roots then. He's apparently a bit too high for Sky at the moment.
It's the fact that the Belkin team appears to have got a new sponsor. Is that a factor in that as well, perhaps?
It could be.
Because the Dutch lottery is coming in. Just on the subject of my scoops, I only got one wrong. That was Geraint Thomas. And my sources were sound, but the information turned out to be incorrect. Let's still see. I still think Edvald Bosenhagen may be on his way. I said BMC. Will probably be on his way. I said BMC. I understand Omega Pharma Quickstep may also be interested in him.
Well, that would make sense. He would be reunited with Rolf Aldag, who was his team manager at HTC, and Brian Holm, of course.
Yeah, any other transfer gossip? Sky have been linked with a lot of riders. Very similar thing happened with Lawrence Ten Dam. They were close to signing him, and his asking price was in the end too high.
I mean, the area that I think they really, really need to address is, the Ardennes Classics, and what happened this year was an unmitigated disaster. They had Sergio Henao, who was unavailable, but they did absolutely nothing in Flèche Wallonne, Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and they were quite embarrassed by how poorly they performed there.
Interviews and analysis. We've got the Tour de France covered. This is a Telegraph Cycling Podcast supported by Jaguar.
Okay, we'll wrap this up in a minute, but Daniel, you've got one little final bit of audio to play, something that you gathered on the rest day, I believe.
Yeah, the Liquigas, I call them Liquigas, they're called Cannondale now, and they might not be Cannondale for much longer because that team's future is very, very uncertain. But at the Cannondale Hotel yesterday, I caught up with Sebastian Weber, who's the German coach of the team, is now the coach of Peter Sagan. He joined the team in the winter, so he's only been working for Sagan for 6 or 7 months. And I spoke to him about Sagan's difficulties early in the tour, his tactical problems, really, the various near misses that he'd had, and asked Sebastian whether he was happy with Sagan, at least from a physical or physiological perspective.
I mean, from a physical point of perspective, I'm totally satisfied with him, especially if talking about the first week. I mean, he was really, really strong, not only in the sprints, but you can see for all the small attacks, short, hard climbs in England and everything. So physically, I think he was in very good conditions. And for the technically part, I mean, I don't think if he by himself made so many mistakes. I think it's also the team, we all together made some technical mistakes maybe. For him it's just getting more and more difficult, you know. Nobody wants to arrive with him at the finish line, obviously. So you have to be a much stronger team in place. And if you don't have that, being a big, big favorite for 3-4 stages in the first week, it's getting more difficult.
There's a lot of attention on these efforts he's been making. Well, I think twice on descents he kind of went off the front with Van Avermaet and Nancy, and then in Sheffield as well. Again, from a physical point of view, how much does that take off his finishing speed then? Because it's another thing that's been said that those efforts cost him stage victories, well, certainly in Nancy.
Yeah, I was thinking the same initially, and then when you look at the power data, I'm not so sure if this effort really costs a lot, because it was the efforts were not that big. I mean, he tries and then he kind of reckons that it doesn't work out as he wants to, and then he backs off. And given his descending skill, he's also descending faster than the other, so that he saves energy. So I would not, I mean, of course there have been like, but it's not like the big drama that he arrived, you know, totally dead at the finish line and cannot do anything anymore. He just tries and then was backing off pretty quickly.
Okay. I spoke to you in the winter, Sebastian, about what you intended to do with Peter. It's your first year working with him. You talked about just making small changes, changing maybe, or tweaking lots of different things. How have those first 6 months gone? And in what areas do you think he's improved?
Well, I mean, obviously, out as supposed. For that, we changed in terms of getting in more longer rides, again, like some over distance rides, so to say. And it's not quite sure if this really worked out. I mean, if you look at the numbers, they were just a tiny bit better than the previous year. But in the races, this didn't show. So it's kind of unsure. And then after the classics, we wanted to focus a little bit more on the sprints, preparing for this Tour de France, which was a little bit disturbed by traveling and different race schedules and so on. But yeah, if you look at this power data, and we sat down before Tour de Suisse in Boulder together and analyzed his power this year compared to last year and the years before and so on. And I mean, he's doing quite well. He's making small improvements, which, I mean, obviously if you're at this high level, you don't make big steps anyway.
Okay, so you know, we've seen in sprints this year that he's perhaps not, you know, winning stages, but still finishing third, fourth, fifth. You don't think he's getting slower?
No, for sure. I don't think he's getting slower. And, you know, you have to see it like this. He doesn't do any specific sprint training. I mean, some accelerations, whatever. But it's not like the training from Greipel or these guys, or, you know, who really do a lot of sprint exercises. He doesn't do any of that. And I would say he has to get slower, which is kind of normal. When he gets older, I mean, he puts more kilometers in, and even during, you know, working with Greipel for tons of years, I mean, a lot of time, he would also get slower during the season, so you constantly have to sometimes come back to your sprint training to gain speed. So whatever, getting back to Peter, is that I think even though if he would recognize that he loses speed or loses sprint power, he could just any time go back and do some sprint training, because he's today without anything specific on that. So I guess whatever, 5 years down the road or so, he could any time put something like this into his training regime and keep the speed or even increase the speed if he wants to.
And what sort of form would that take, the sprint training? Just lots of efforts on the road, lots of, you know, sprint efforts on the road, or would you go to a track, or and what's the best way of approaching that?
It depends a little bit on what kind of sprinter you are. Like if you compare him, for for example, to maybe Greipel. Greipel has a lot of form, needed more sprint work. But for example, Viviani here is super fast coming from the track in terms of leg speed, but lacks a little bit of the high force, of the high power. So definitely, you know, it depends on where you come from. But this is the two ends, like the force, the power, and the speed is what you want to work on.
Okay, let's wrap up there from Luchon. We'll be back tomorrow at Pla d'Adet, a summit finish in the Pyrenees. Lots of excitement about how Thibaut Pinot will get on, whether Valverde will crack what Nibali will do. So we'll say cheerio, and we hope to be joined also there, I should add, by Francois Thomazeau, as I mentioned earlier. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you. Very serious podcast tonight, do you think?
Quite serious.
Almost mirthless.
Bit more humour tomorrow.
Okay.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.